Michael Austin grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's one of those religions, as you probably know, described as high demand. That is, it expects more from its members than just attendance and affinity. There's an emphasis on perfection in the faith. And even when he was a kid, Michael says he felt a heavy burden. He was always worried he'd screw it up. And then one day in fifth grade, he did.
I was using an encyclopedia classroom set, and I drew a mustache on, I think it was Winston Churchill. I felt really bad, and I erased the mustache. But when I did that, I erased some of the ink. I put it back on the shelf, and I went home. And then it just hit me. I had done a really horrible thing. I spent the night in absolute terror. I had to face school property. I was going to be kicked out of school. I was going to be excommunicated from the church. I had sinned grievously and probably beyond the ability to be forgiven. The next day, I showed it to my teacher and told her what I had done. She said, "It's okay." And then I felt just this amazing sense of peace and well-being. I was clean again. But a couple of days later, I realized that I did something else that was bad. I then ran and confessed to my mother. And I did that over and over and over again. After I had felt so horrible and felt that I'd done something wrong, when I confessed that, then I felt peaceful and calm and strong, like nothing was wrong in my life. So the overwhelming feeling of well-being after a confession became something that I wanted to feel again. It happened again when I was about 14, again when I was about 17, and at that point, it was all of the adolescent things and thoughts of sex and viewing something on television that was questionable, and I would then go and confess. I confessed two or three times to bishops right before I went on my mission, and every time I did, I would feel better. Then I would think of something else, or I would do something else, and I would go back, and then that need to confess was stronger and stronger. But none of us knew what was going on. None of us had a name for this thing. And I was fairly certain that I was unique. I was the only person in the world who felt this way. I felt that I had a highly developed conscience, that I was in some sense chosen. This was an indication of the greatness that I was probably in store for because I did have such a highly developed conscience. But it strained my relationships with almost everybody. I just had this continual need to confess, confess. So when I was 30 years old, I had children. I was experiencing a pretty serious recurrence of these symptoms. I also was a scholar of 18th century British literature, and I was in the process of writing a book. And one of the things that I came across was Joseph Kerocci's book called The Doubting Disease. When I read that, and then I read the whole book, I realized that what I was going through had a name, scrupulosity. Once I knew the word for it, once you know that it's a thing and that it has a name, then you can read the literature. And I found a fairly enormous body of literature, and all of it struck me as exactly what was going on with me. So I know that I have a tendency to feel anxiety. And when I feel anxiety, my brain goes around looking for things to fasten it onto and feel guilty about. It happens still. I have a lot of strategies now for dealing with it that I haven't had a full-scale breakdown in about 20 years.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Scrupulosity is a real thing. It's a psychological condition marked by an almost pathological sense of guilt. And it manifests in different ways. People will pray or perform religious rituals excessively. As you heard with Michael, they'll confess over and over again. Today in the program, we're talking about it. We were interested in it because many of the stories we heard came from Latter-day Saints, both those afflicted and those who study it, like Deborah Theobald McClendon. She's a licensed psychologist here in Utah. Her practice focuses on treating scrupulosity. She has a book that comes at the subject from an LDS perspective, which brings up an important question. Do high-demand or high-intensity religions like Mormonism produce more people with scrupulosity? That is, does a particular religion cause it? As you'll hear, there's a difference of opinion about that. But whatever it's called, it's been around for hundreds of years. But it's really only been in the last few that people are studying it and working out treatment. McClendon told us when she was studying, she learned all about different kinds of psychological disorders, but never did she encounter scrupulosity.
When I learned about treating OCD, I just remember being taught that there are different, maybe you might call flavors of OCD. People like to use the word themes of OCD, basically subtypes. They can be concerns around germs and contamination, symmetry, checking and ordering. And I remember them just saying it can also include religious doubts. And there was no discussion about how maybe these subtypes might look different from each other, how they might be treated from each other. I graduated and became licensed and was practicing just private practice part-time for quite a few years. And then within a short period of time, I had two different clients that came in and said that they had scrupulosity. And they used this word scrupulosity that is not in the diagnostic statistical manual. And the word scrupulosity is still not in the current edition, which is the DSM now 5. When I was trained, it was the DSM 4. So I absolutely knew nothing about this area of mental health at all. And so I had these two clients come in at different times, and I felt so embarrassed, I had to go look up the word. I didn't know the word. So it was just a very eye-opening experience, and I was led to write an Ensign article.
Let's just explain for people who don't know. Ensign is a magazine published by the church.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they call it Liahona now, actually.
Okay,
Ensign's
right.
An outdated term now. Okay. Anyway, they contacted me and asked me to write an article on this concept of anxiety manifesting differently than spiritual manifestations or revelation. I felt that there was a part two that needed to be written. And so I wrote an additional article focusing on scrupulosity because of these experiences with my clients. I realized it was a completely underserved, underrepresented population. So that was kind of the beginning. Because once the article came out, people started contacting me for scrupulosity treatment. So I went to town and did a lot of homework, a lot of research in all the academic journals, and they use the term scrupulosity. So it's interesting that that term's not in the diagnostic statistical manual. And so the rest is kind of history from there.
What do people need to know about where you're coming from? You don't pretend to be detached from the subject in terms of your own kind of religious affiliation. You are a practicing member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yes, most people find me through the Ensign articles, and so they know already that I am not endorsed by the church officially in the sense, but recognizing that they don't publish people who are not faithful members of the church. I don't make a pretense to try to hide any of that because my clients take comfort in knowing that I am active. There's a lot of fear with this type of treatment that the therapist may try to, quote, lead them astray or have them just say, well, if your church is causing you so much stress, you should just leave. And most of these people aren't interested in leaving. They want to figure out how to work through the fear. And so my clients up front know that I'm an active member of the church. I hold a temple recommend. My husband has served as a bishop. And that becomes kind of the premise of why they're willing to trust me when we do some treatment exercises that do feel risky. Yeah. They feel scary to people.
You say in the book that to understand scrupulosity, you have to understand obsessive compulsive disorder. So just give us a basic, I guess, primer on that. This is a disorder in a class of mental disorders. People suffer from obsessions, which are intrusive and irrational. Just give us a sense of that. What do we need to understand about OCD before we move on to scrupulosity?
So OCD is comprised of obsessions, which are unwanted, distressing, and irrational thoughts. It's a really important premise because a lot of people with scrupulosity think very much that there's a lot of meaning and perhaps even revelatory meaning for them in the types of thoughts that they have. So you have to understand an obsession is something that they don't want. It's ego dystonic. It feels alien to them. It's not who they are and it's not what they want and they don't like thinking about it. It's distressing because it's not who they are. And it's irrational. So an obsession, the longer you try to think about it, process called rumination, which is just excessive replaying over and over. I mean, the people who are listening who know about rumination, it is just maddening. So the obsession piece is huge, particularly in scrupulosity. Scrupulosity is known to generally have fewer outward compulsions than a lot of the other themes of OCD, such as someone with a germ or contamination fear who may be overtly washing their hands even hundreds of times a day. So the compulsions are actions. And here's an important piece. It can be a physical action like washing hands, but it can also be a mental action like praying. Rumination that I just talked about is actually an OCD compulsion. It's probably the biggest one in scrupulosity, because people are always trying to figure it out. What's the seed of my faith problem? Why am I so afraid of God? What is going on? And they're just trying to figure it out over and over and over again. So these obsessions and compulsions are very time consuming. They take huge chunks of people's day. And this cycle, the obsessive compulsive cycle, has gotten out of hand to where the person cannot contain it in a healthy, appropriate way. And oftentimes it becomes impairing and people cannot necessarily live a normal functional life. Scrupulosity, which is basically a religious OCD or a moral OCD, as you mentioned earlier, is a subtype of OCD. So what that means is it is OCD.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah. Well, and we'll dig into the particulars as we go. Let me back up a second. What does it mean, scrupulosity? The word, it comes from the Latin word for small stone, which I think is there's something quite telling about that.
Right. I mean, have you ever been on a hike and you get a pebble that's kind of hit up on your ankle and it's dropped into your shoe?
Yeah.
You don't walk very long before you're stopping to get that thing out because it's annoying, it's irritating, and it's even painful. It's not this huge crisis. You didn't just have your ankle amputated, but it is just there irritating and rubbing and agitating until you get it out. And so that becomes very telling when you think about scrupulosity. These people are just being tormented unceasingly by their anxiety. And so they may be engaged in something for their employment, for example, and they may be busy doing a project and being very successful thinking about their project. And then as soon as they're done and they've got like a 15-minute break or whatever, and their brain kind of gets unoccupied again, it'll go right back to that stone that's agitating and going, well, what if this and what if that? Or, ooh, what did you mean here? Or what about this? And, oh, da-da-da-da-da. And that's kind of the essence of scrupulosity.
We'll say more about this in a moment, but scrupulosity can be seen in all religious traditions. What about Unitarians or, you know, other more, I guess, permissive or I guess progressive religions, are they less inclined to trigger OCD, or would you see it everywhere?
You would see it everywhere because the cause of the scrupulosity is not the religious belief. The cause of the OCD scrupulosity is having an anxiety disorder that's being manifest in an extreme way with obsessions and compulsions. So it's OCD. So if you have OCD, even if it hasn't manifested yet, you're going to be prone to have OCD in your life, and then you tend to be religious. The OCD tends to manifest in religious ways for some people because OCD tends to attack what people value the most. So if someone is having OCD and they're religious, you're likely to see it in all religions. It seems to me that when you have religions that do have a higher demand feature, more strict rules or guidelines, that's just more breeding ground for OCD, because then there's more opportunity for uncertainty for the person to come in to say, well, did I meet that standard good enough? Yeah. Did I do this? Yeah. Did I do that? But the research really doesn't bear out that someone in a high demand religion would necessarily have OCD more than someone in a more permissive religion.
That seems like a really critical point, because I think people listening now, whether they're, you know, affiliated with the LDS Church or not, are going to wonder that. There are aspects. I think it would be fair to say that the LDS Church has high expectations. I don't think it's inaccurate or unfair to say it's a high demand faith, and that it would just make it seems like common sense to say that a faith like that would be more inclined to trigger scrupulosity or an OCD. I mean, one of the things you mentioned, you said 1% of the world's population has this affliction of OCD. And I think you said to us, I want to get these numbers right, that about 5% of that 1% is going to struggle with scrupulosity. So in that sense, it's, I don't know if rare is the right way to put it, but it seems somewhat rare. But you also mentioned that the studies have shown in a more predominantly religious community, I'm guessing you could say Islamic communities, Orthodox Jewish communities, or Utah, that number goes up between 5% to maybe 40%. Did I get that right?
Yeah, the range is kind of ridiculous. That doesn't really feel helpful.
It doesn't. But that's the question. Like, what do we know? Do we have any data about Latter-day Saints and how this scrupulosity is afflicting them? And because that is a big question. Is it different in a place like Utah where you have a lot of Latter-day Saints?
Wow.
So what do we know about that?
Yeah. So the 5% to 40% range, and again, that's not 5% to 40% of people. That's 5% to 40% of the 1% who have OCD.
Yeah.
That's just a general research that's been done on a lot of different populations. Obviously, if you have more people in an area that are part of a particular religious community, then the people with OCD in that area are more likely to be of that faith, and you may see it more there. But you might be interested in one study that was done in 2015. It was a doctoral dissertation, and this was conducted on members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by an individual who was not a member of the church, so there's not any kind of bias that way. And this person found that the more religious members of the church were more likely to report lower levels of obsessions and compulsions, and correspondingly, the less religious individuals were more likely to report higher levels of the traits. So mental health—
Wait, how do you make sense of that?
Yeah.
Because that goes completely contrary to what you would think. You would think those who are more inclined to be more devout—
Right.
Would be more inclined to have these kinds of obsessions. But what you're saying is those who aren't, maybe even some, I'm thinking Latter-day Saints who are on the fence, are the ones who would at least report these obsessions.
Right.
How would that work? Why would that work?
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's been done about mental health and religiosity in general. And the research is pretty consistent that says a religious belief and involvement in religious belief helps people with their mental health. You have lower levels of mental health problems and lower levels of distress if you do have mental health problems, if you are religiously active. Hmm. These religious beliefs provide coping. They teach people how to cope with problems, how to be resilient, how to find peace, even in turmoil. And so religious belief tends to be related to a lower prevalence of disorder. So they're inversely correlated. As one goes up, one goes down. There was another study done within the fundamentalist Protestant congregation. And the fundamental Protestant congregation had a very strict literal interpretation of their religious dogma. Hmm. And so it was believed by the researcher that they would have higher levels of scrupulosity. And against their hypothesis, they actually found that it was not significantly related to scrupulosity. So their level of intensity about their religious doctrine was independent of the severity of scrupulosity. Now, there was another non-clinical study done internationally, and they found that the higher level of severity in religious orientation was related to scrupulosity. So what I'm saying is, I look at those studies overall, we would have to say the studies are mixed. Hmm. So if you want to take a little caution as you interpret that, but that's some of the information that's out there.
So it's not just an affliction related to the LDS Church, you say, of course, but what are the characteristics of the faith that would trigger scrupulosity? Let's talk about that. And one of the accounts that you mention in the book, in fact, it's the first one. This man says that he began to think that he was, as he put it, responsible for perfecting himself, and that he would set these extreme and unrealistic expectations. Now, explain what that means for a non-Latter-day Saint, because I want to get to this idea of perfection. It's not necessarily unique to Mormonism, but I think it's something that Latter-day Saints think a lot about, you know, feeling as though a person needs to achieve a kind of perfection. How does that fit into this story of scrupulosity?
Right. So Jesus Christ said, "Be therefore perfect, even as I and your Father in heaven are imperfect," right? Not an exact quote. We aspire for perfection according to the words of our Savior. And so within the LDS Church, the issue of perfectionism comes up a ton. Now, it is a normal cognitive domain of OCD. So anybody with OCD, you're probably going to be seeing these types of toxic perfectionistic tendencies. Another piece is confession, because there is uncertainty built into, well, does this need to be confessed? Does this need to be confessed? Another one that I see a lot is the law of chastity, because we obviously, as members of this church, have a high moral code when it comes to sexual morality. And so there is a lot of uncertainty about what types of behaviors are okay, especially, you know, when young people are dating. So that's another area that I've seen quite a bit.
Are you sure that churches, in this case, the LDS Church, but there are other cases of other faiths, that they should be let off the hook? I mean, you write in the book, scrupulosity is not caused by a person's religious denomination, that it's an anxiety problem. But don't the characteristics of certain religious and moral beliefs bear some kind of responsibility for at least triggering some of this toxic anxiety? Because the question is there really any point in asking leaders of any faith, in this case Mormonism, to kind of back off on some of the precepts that may be causing some of their members to overly fixate or obsess about worthiness, to back off on, you know, reiterating the question of sexual purity, reiterating the idea of perfection? It makes me wonder if church leaders are aware of it, and if they should be, and if they're, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't say so, because they are speaking to a worldwide population. And if you think about the number of members of the church worldwide who they're speaking to, and they do not have scrupulosity, that's most everybody, right? We're talking about 99 point, right?
Right, but aren't we also talking about the lamb that's lost? Isn't that the isn't that a critical message of Christ's teachings, that I'll leave the flock here, they're doing fine, and I really need to minister to the one that's lost. Even if it's 5, 10, 15% of 1%, which you say scrupulosity is, I mean, isn't that worth some sort of consideration?
Well, and I think that's why we are seeing the Ensign articles, the Liahona articles, the LDS Living articles, the podcasts coming out to bear that. It's important to have religious standards, and I think that that's important. The piece here is not to adjust the message or relax the standards. The piece is, if you are struggling with toxic anxiety and you're in this obsessive compulsive cycle that's tormenting you, you need to get the treatment for the anxiety so that you can enjoy the positive benefits of your religious belief. I believe in ministering, absolutely, but I don't believe that that means you start relaxing your doctrinal position for all members of the church because you might trigger somebody. I think that's on them. I mean, how many disorders with mental illness exist? Now, how many disorders for physical illness? And everybody is suffering with some sort of affliction. We can't water down everything to satisfy. You're always going to trigger somebody. The responsibility is on the person to say, I'm going to get the treatment I need, whether it's for a physical illness or a mental illness. They need to get the treatment.
Let me ask you finally, you say you only do scrupulosity now and OCD. That's the focus now of your practice. Why?
The way that this process went down for me, I really feel like this was a mission that my Heavenly Father asked me to take on. He needed somebody to be willing to join these clients on their journey and to represent them and educate myself to learn how to help them.
Deborah McClendon, she's a licensed psychologist. Her practice is devoted to treating people with scrupulosity. She has a book called Freedom from Scrupulosity, Reclaiming Your Religious Experience from Anxiety and OCD. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about scrupulosity. It's a psychological disorder that causes people to obsess over moral or religious matters. They'll pray excessively or confess compulsively. And one of the questions that comes up here is whether there's more scrupulosity in high-demand religious communities. You know, do the doctrines and expectations of Orthodox Judaism or Mormonism create or at least trigger it? Deborah McClendon doesn't think so, but Chris Miller says it might. Miller is an assistant professor of biological psychology at California State University, Fresno, and for years he studied scrupulosity, including his time as a student at Brigham Young University. Now he's no longer a member of the faith, but he told us this week throughout his life, several of his close LDS friends showed symptoms of scrupulosity, and that piqued his interest.
I could feel the intensity of what they were going through. And I do believe that the intensity of being immersed in that culture was contributing to their suffering. Yeah, I do. And I am quite certain that in each of their experiences, when they made the very difficult decision to leave their religion of origin, they immediately felt quite a bit better. And over a longer period of time, remitted from OCD and the depressive symptomatology that went along with it. Among multiple close friends and family members, that was their experience in every one of their cases.
So what is it? You know, to the larger question, what is scrupulosity? It's often identified as a form of OCD.
Okay.
But you say that might not be quite right, that it fits in OCD in some ways, but in other ways it might not. So where does it fit, I guess?
Yeah, I think there's kind of a range on it. I'm not real dogmatic about whether to continue to diagnose it as a subtype of OCD or not. I think it's okay to continue to diagnose it as a subtype of OCD, but it's a different sort of subtype than the others. You know, the contamination obsessions and the washing compulsions, or the checking and the ordering and the symmetry subtypes. It's sort of like those, but it's different, and it's meaningfully different, and it doesn't respond to the traditional first line treatments that need to be significantly modified in order for those treatments to work for scrupulosity. Or we might need to diagnose it as a separate sort of disorder. It's somewhere in that range.
Well, this is a way that helped me understand it. It's something that you had mentioned to us before, that so if OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder, in scrupulosity you have the obsessive part, but not the, maybe not as much the compulsive part. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the compulsive part comes out in a religious context, often in compulsive confession to religious authorities. That, I think, is the strongest compulsive thing that's fairly common, but isn't always present. But the purely obsessional type is a much stronger feature in scrupulosity than other subtypes of OCD. And the compulsive part is much less intense and much less frequent.
But there is a part that I wanted to ask you about. It's something you said, that there are some features that scrupulosity shares in common with a number of religious faiths. And that is sometimes referred to as magical thinking or magical ideation. And this gets us to this other thing, that moral action thought fusion. Break this down for us, if you would.
Yeah, so there's a number of kind of cognitive features of OCD and scrupulosity, and even a religious way of thinking or mindset that are shared in common, and are, I think it's fair to say, probably are risk factors for OCD and scrupulosity. Thought action fusion is a good example. So that's the idea that your thoughts sort of invariably lead to behaviors or actions. There's a direct fusion between your thoughts and your actions or your behaviors. And that's a strong sort of theme or teaching in a lot of high intensity religions, including Mormonism, that you are supposed to very carefully control and regulate your thoughts, particularly ones that are sexual in nature. There's a moral obligation to regulate your thoughts, right? And by keeping your thoughts pure, your mind pure, you're going to be able to keep your behaviors pure.
One of the things you also mentioned, one of the sort of cognitive features that you explain, is that patients who have scrupulosity, they experience these periods of, as you put it, disabling confusion or doubt about, you know, violating certain sins. Or the exact particular precise content of a moral precept. What's this feature? Explain this one to us.
Yeah, and that can kind of get wrapped up, I think, in the example that we just discussed, even. If you're having, you know, an intrusive thought, which, you know, every human being does, you know, we're all sexual creatures that invariably have these thoughts, and yet your religion of origin may teach you that these are impure thoughts. That could be confusing to an adolescent, right, who's coming of age, and so they're experiencing one thing from their religion of origin that's telling them that you shouldn't have these impure thoughts, and yet they're perfectly natural thoughts and urges to have, right? And so that's a state of confusion, and they're feeling guilty about that, and it can confound them, right, and lead to a high degree of anxiety. And that's just, you know, an example that's, I think, all adolescents in high-intensity religions that are teaching sexually conservative ideas are going to experience, and it's going to be a risk factor for scrupulosity.
So have you been able to identify certain characteristics in Mormonism, for example, that are could be triggers for scrupulosity or features of scrupulosity. I've heard, for example, compulsive confession as being one of these features, a compulsive sense of wanting to overshare and reveal certain things. Are these characteristics common among Latter-day Saints or others, and as you say, high-intensity religions?
Yeah, I think the clearest or the most noticeable overt behavior is really the compulsive confession, where the individual is going into, and you know, in case of Mormonism, the bishop, or in case of Catholicism, the confessional booth, priest, or you know, a Jewish rabbi, or whatever the case may be, and they're repeatedly confessing the same sin over and over again, or variations of the same sin over and over again, or minor infractions over and over again, and they appear to not be getting relief out of it, or you know, they're confessing things that are so minor that an ordinary person in that religion may not, or they're wanting to have long, drawn-out conversations about it, you know, those sorts of things.
So I think this gets us to what seems to be an important question for our purposes, because we wanted to get a deeper understanding of how scrupulosity interacts with these higher-demand religions like Mormonism, because I think it's fair to say there may be some differences of opinion among people who studied the disorder about that. So one of the important questions seems to be, is there more scrupulosity in a specific religion? Which is to say, is there more scrupulosity among Latter-day Saints than, say, you know, Episcopalians, for example? Can we say that?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are a few studies that have looked at specific religious groups and comparisons of them. And my understanding is that there seem to be somewhat higher rates among them, high-intensity religions, but there also could be some, to some degree, some self-selection involved in that. But yeah, I agree that there's room for some difference of opinion on them, including, you know, some criticism in the way that those studies were designed and so forth.
But it gets to, I mean, there's someone like Deborah McClendon, who's on our program, who's written a book that seems mostly designed for Latter-day Saints, although she says the book is for everyone. But she says in the book this, let me quote it: "The social science research on scrupulosity does not support the assumption that religion causes scrupulosity." And she mentions in the book that there's this difference between religion causing the disorder and religion as just a backdrop in the disorder. And so the way that sort of I understood the argument from her was that scrupulosity, like OCD, is, you know, spread throughout the population, but that number is fixed. There's so many people who have scrupulosity, and that's distributed throughout the world. So it doesn't matter your religious faith. There are going to be as many Episcopalians who suffer from scrupulosity as Orthodox Jews, for example, or as you know, practicing Latter-day Saints. What do you make of that?
I would respectfully disagree with the intensity of her position on it. I would agree that it's difficult to make a case with the empirical research, but I think the research hasn't been done to address that particular issue. It's not accurate to say that the empirical research supports the position that religion does not increase rates of scrupulosity. I don't think that's fair. And it's my observation, both from a experiential point of view and from a theoretical point of view, with the shared cognitive risk factors that high intensity religions almost certainly do contribute to the rates of scrupulosity. I would be very surprised if those studies were done, that it didn't to some degree contribute to a significantly higher rate of scrupulosity. I wouldn't be surprised that to some degree it's both. I think in many cases it, you know, these high intensity religions are just contributing the backdrop or the form or the content
for many individuals. I think that is happening. But I also think that they are driving the rates of scrupulosity up as well for some individuals. I'm quite certain that that's the case as well. So I think it's likely both.
There's another question I wanted to ask. McClendon addresses in her book this idea that scrupulosity, you know, the question of whether or not it is caused by being too religious. And she says in her book that the study findings are mixed. She does acknowledge that. But she says the research generally shows that a person's intensity of scrupulous distress is not significantly related to a person's strength of religious devotion. So let me put the question this way. If you have two people who are Latter-day Saints and one is really super, you know, hyper devout, the other one is more lax. You know, they go to church, but they're not, they don't get too much into it. I think what McClendon is suggesting is that either one of those could have scrupulosity. And in fact, the hyper religious one is not in fact inclined to have scrupulosity tendencies. Not more inclined. Does that seem right to you, where you have two people who are have sort of a different level of devotion, they both could have scrupulosity?
Yeah, it's possible. It's kind of difficult to disentangle the intensity of their scrupulosity and their religious devotion, because they could be at different trajectories in their devotion to their religion, their departure potentially from their religion, and the degree to which their symptomatology is moral in nature versus religious in nature. So it's all very difficult to disentangle, I think.
Is that part of the problem in talking about scrupulosity? It's just how complicated it is. It's one of the things you mentioned to us, is you said that there's this certain level of education that's required to understand the research that's out there. So trying to convey what it all means to people is complicated, and that must make it difficult to communicate about it.
Very, yes. That's exactly right. And I think just raising awareness that this is an issue that people are suffering from and that they generally remain quiet about, you know, they're quietly suffering from, is important. It's important to reduce the things that are contributing to their suffering, and it's important to provide them with access to support and help while they're suffering from it, and to empower them to make decisions that are going to be best for them. I mean, certainly getting clinical help, you know, objective clinical help, and then empowering them to make whatever decisions are best for them, whether that means whether they decide to remain in their religion of origin and work out a lifestyle that is suitable for them in that religion of origin, or whether that means departing from their religion of origin and building a life that's very different than the one that they began.
So that's a treatment option. That is, and which is to say that some of the moral principles that are important to religious people, like Latter-day Saints and others, and, you know, these high-demand religions, it can be said that those principles could actually do more harm than good. And in a treatment scenario, it might be advisable to tell a patient, it's just not worth it. You probably should leave.
I think they should be aware of that as an option. I don't think it's necessarily in the patient's best interest to be so heavy-handed about that, you know, to tell them what to do either way.
Sure.
You know, you know.
That's not what they do.
Exactly. No. Right. And, a skilled ethical clinician really shouldn't be doing that either way. I think it's important to understand that there is going to be a conflict of interest among clergy, for sure, and also potentially with clinicians that share the patient's religion of origin as well. We've also seen that in many high-intensity religions, there's not the greatest track record of that happening throughout history, right? So I think there needs to be some accountability as well.
Chris Miller, he's an assistant professor of biological psychology at California State University, Fresno. You're listening to Radio West. What should a religious leader, an LDS religious leader, I'll say, for our purposes, what should they do to respond to this disorder? And I don't know if you have any insight, having been in the faith or talking to people who had suffered from this affliction. Do you have any sense of whether or not leaders are thinking about this or concerned about this? But what should they do anyway?
That's a great question. I think there's going to be a range on it, but I can tell you that there's a lot of really good people who care about their loved ones, of course, and their communities and are concerned about this. And then there's going to be a lot of people that are dismissive of it as well. I think any institution, regardless of what religion we're talking about, or institution we're talking about, if you care about your community, you're going to see signs of them taking it seriously, both in determining what's contributing to it, you know, doing a thorough investigation to determine what's contributing to it, what can be done about it, and then investing resources to fix whatever is contributing to it and to support people who are going through it. You shouldn't be seeing signs of that happening.
You know, it's interesting the terms that we use for certain religions. We say that Mormonism is high demand. You used the term high intensity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think both are fair. Uh-huh.
Well, let me employ the high intensity term here. And I wonder, would it help, do you think, if leaders and teachers and others just kind of toned down the intensity? That maybe that's some guidance to offer, and that may be helpful for everyone involved.
Personally, I think so. You know, the hellfire and damnation sort of sermons are, one would think, contributing to anxiety levels, right? And you would think contributing to the risk for these sorts of things. And maybe these high-intensity or high-demand religions are not making it particularly easy for individuals to kind of find their, you know, they're kind of forced to fit themselves into a way that doesn't necessarily work for them. So would that make it more suitable for them or easier for them? I think so. Is that something that religions that tend to be rather high intensity or high demand or dogmatic, are they likely to do that? I sort of doubt it. But that's, you know.
And why do you think that? But why do you doubt it? Is it that there's a feeling and that you have to sacrifice certain core principles?
Right.
To prevent a reaction like scrupulosity, and that may not be worth it to religious leaders.
I think so. I mean, they're rather devoted to core principles. There's a kind of a pretty literal interpretation of sacred texts. You know, they're rather categorical and dogmatic about certain things. And you can look at, you know, the demands that have been made over the years that they, you know, change in response to, you know, social pressures and political pressure to change in certain things that they just haven't budged on. You know, so being more accepting toward LGBTQ issues, right? And their religious hasn't been budge on that over the years. So I sort of doubt that it's going to happen in response to other things as well.
Chris Miller, he's an assistant professor in the psychology department at California State University, Fresno. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.